For over half a century, London W12 7RJ Wood Lane became the spiritual home of British television. Designed by the architect Graham Dawbarn, this was the UK's first purpose-built TV hub with the cutting-edge camera technology, 8 bespoke studios, production galleries, and the now legendary BBC bar. Well, for many, BBC Television Centre came to represent the magic and glamour of British entertainment, light entertainment, glossy, glamorous shows, and hosted everything from Auntie's New Bloomers to Z Cars behind those famous double doors. To mark 10 years since the closure of Britain's most famous television studios, Beyond the Title welcomes some of the BBC's best-loved faces to remember and celebrate the history and legacy of TV's first dream factory. So, join Josh and the team as they remember BBC Television Centre.
Iconic writer and broadcaster Sarah Green burst onto the entertainment landscape as presenter of the flagship BBC children's television phenomenon, Blue Peter, alongside Peter Duncan and Simon Groom. In 1983, she joined DJ Mike Reed and the late Keith Chegwin for the children's extravaganza, Saturday Superstore. Yet by 1987, times were changing, and TV was ready for a new approach to Saturday morning, which saw her unite with the great Philip Schofield for the iconic Going Live, alongside the double act Trevor and Simon and the heroic Gordon the Gopher. In 1992, Sarah would cement cult status when she appeared alongside the legendary Michael Parkinson and her late husband Mike Smith for the elaborate Halloween spoof Ghostwatch. As part of Beyond the Title's Television Centre season, I caught up with the Evergreen broadcaster to celebrate her BBC tenure and her memories of working in Britain's most famous television factory. Ladies and gentlemen, Sarah Green.
So welcome to this very special podcast, celebrating the magic of TV Centre. What were your first memories of being aware of TV Centre, and how did this ignite your passion for live TV?
Right. Well, this might not be what you're expecting, but the first time I went to Television Centre was when I was probably about 4 or 5 years old, because my mum was an actress. And in those days, they used to broadcast dramas live. And so my dad and I would take my mum to Television Centre. We would take her, you could drive right in those days, up to main reception. And we'd park right outside in my dad's little Austin van. And we'd go in and wait in main reception while my mum appeared in an episode of either a programme like Z Cars, which was a very popular police drama that ran for years, or Dixon of Dock Green, which was another police drama. And they did them all live from Television Centre. Can you believe? Can you imagine how terrifying that was? Because it's all very well doing live programmes when it's going live, or when it's, well, Blue Peter a bit more scary, really, because it's very structured and scripted. But if it's a drama and you're playing somebody else and everything is meant to be absolutely perfect, that must have been absolutely terrifying. But of course, that's the way they did it. So that's what my mum did. And we would sit in main reception and they'd have a TV on, you know, not the big bank of screens you'd get now, but they'd have a television on with what was going on, what was going out on BBC One television at that time. And I'd see my mum on screen in main reception. We'd wait for her to finish and then she'd come back out and we'd go home again. So that was that was my first experience at Television Centre, and it felt very normal. It felt just like going to work. So in a sense, later on, when then the next time I went to Television Centre was as an actress to record some of the studio sequences from a drama that I was in, very much recorded, very much not live by that stage, and that was called Swish of the Curtain. And that was one of those Sunday evening classic drama serials that the BBC used to do. And it was a lovely thing to do. It was primarily aimed at children, But it was all set in the 1930s about a group of kids who had their own little theatre company. So it was right up my street. And that's the next time I was at Television Centre. And then the next time I was at Television Centre was to appear as a guest on Blue Peter to talk about Swish of the Curtain. And that's where the bosses of children's television and obviously of Blue Peter saw me and wondered if I would be suitable to audition for that programme. And I did it. I did it as a bet with my mates who said, if I did the audition, could I please bring back loads of badges? Of course, it doesn't work like that. Because even if you borrow one to do the audition, you have to give it back again. The only way you get one for real is if you deserve it. Well, anyway, after that, the rest is history, because I did get offered the role on Blue Peter. And against my agent's advice, because he thought I was a very good actress and I should stick at that, I decided to take the job because it was an adventure. Simple as that.
This next question kind of lines up with that. Because. It's almost like you knew what the next question was going to be.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. In 1980, you were unveiled as part of the lineup for the new look Blue Peter alongside Peter Duncan and Simon Groom. In what ways did you feel a pressing responsibility to replicate the magic of the trio of Singleton, Purvis and Noakes?
I didn't really feel a pressure in that department because, well, one of the reasons, and I don't know if this is something that would go against me in some ways, but I wasn't a Blue Peter viewer as a child, which was probably a good thing. So I didn't go in there with huge preconceptions. And I can't remember the reason that I wasn't a viewer. I mean, I think when I got a little bit past the sort of younger age group of viewers. I mean, when I was in the early age group of Blue Peter viewers, say about 4 or 5, I don't think I watched much telly. I think I was out and about doing things all the time. When I got a little bit older, I was a Magpie viewer, which was the ITV reply to Blue Peter. It was their version. And I used to watch that. So when I started on Blue Peter, my main pressure was trying to work out how to be me on television, because I'd only ever played somebody else. I'd played a character. I'd played a role. That was my job, becoming somebody else. So having to be yourself was the hardest role I'd ever taken on, to do that on television. And at first, I did it completely the wrong way around. What I tried to do, because I was just trying to grab a hold of something to try and capture how to be me or how to play the part of a Blue Peter presenter, because I didn't have that history with the programme. And so what I did was I tried to be Tina Heath, who was my immediate predecessor. And, of course, that didn't work because I'm not Tina Heath and we're nothing like each other. But at first I thought that was the way to do it. And I suppose it took me about 6 months, because when I joined the programme, it was right before the summer break. And so for those months worth of programs leading up to the summer break, I was sort of scrabbling around being Tina. And then after the summer break came back and it gradually started to feel much more familiar. And I think a lot of that had to do with not just what a brilliant mentor Biddy Baxter was, the editor of Blue Peter, but just as much as that, the relationship I had with Simon and Peter, who were like my big brothers. And Peter, similarly, he'd only ever been an actor and played roles. So we were each finding our feet in that department. But we were such a close-knit team I believe. And I don't know if that came across on television at the time, but we absolutely relied on each other. And I think that friendship transmitted across the airwaves. Now, of course, as a kid, as a child watching that, you'd probably take that for granted almost. And what's best is if that's not noticeable. It's just something that comes across as people who are enjoying each other's company, but even more important, enjoying your company as a viewer and knowing that we can't do this show without you, especially Blue Peter, because we were so reliant on all those item ideas for the show coming in from viewers who just happen to be children who have the best ideas in the world, because they're not all hampered by other worries and pressures, hopefully, you know.
We've kind of linked into the next question again. So Josh's next question was, in your opinion, how integral was the legendary Biddy Baxter to the durability of Blue Peter? What's her legacy on the longevity of the show?
It's very existence, I think. I mean, Blue Peter had been around for a few years before Biddy joined the programme. And she took it to a whole different level. Hers was the idea of the Blue Peter Garden. She and her opposite number, Edward Barnes, who at that stage was the producer on the programme, he later became the head of children's programmes. And I always refer to Biddy and Edward as my TV mum and dad, actually, because they were the ones who were responsible for hiring me and changing the course of my life. And that sounds a bit dramatic, but honestly, it is absolutely true. Because, you know, you're going along a certain pathway. And in my case, it was to be an actress and then hopefully develop some of the other things that I'd worked on beforehand in the terms of writing and directing and possibly going back into theatre again. I mean, my secret is that I had wanted to be running the National Theatre by the time I was 30. Not that I'm a megalomaniac or anything, but, you know, that was my idea. And this changed it all completely, because suddenly there was something that was so hard, so difficult, doing live television, but so, so flipping enjoyable as well when it went well. Such a challenge. And Biddy and Edward made that possible for me. Sadly, we lost Edward last year. He was 92. Biddy will be 90 this year. I can't believe it. And I get to see her. I try and see her. We get together every 6 months. And she, you know, I was asked to make a speech for Biddy on her 80th birthday. And in order to do that properly, because she asked me to make the speech, so no pressure there. And I went and interviewed just quietly a group of people to ask them their thoughts and memories. And it was fascinating, actually. And I found out a lot more about Biddy from doing those little interviews that I then used in the speech that I gave. But she really was fearless, and she would walk into the top executive offices, even when she was told. I mean, there's one of the best stories ever was she had to go and see one of the big cheeses at the BBC to ratify the whole business of getting the space behind the kitchens, a television centre. There was just this empty space, which she thought would make a great garden. And what a good idea to have a garden. People said to her, well, why interested children having gardens? And she said, why wouldn't they be interested in gardens? And she said, the most important thing is people who haven't got gardens, which is, you know, millions and millions of people, this can be their garden. And they can do the ideas of how it's planted out and everything, and to grow things. I mean, she was so ahead of her time, really. And Anyway, so she went to see the Grand Fromage, and it said no entry on his door. And his secretary was sitting outside because it was a him and it was a female secretary, those being those days. And the secretary, and she said, no, you can't go in there. But he just looked at her and smiled and walked straight through the door that said no entry. Mm. And that sums it up. Walked through the door that says no entry. And that's Spiddy's legacy, as far as I'm concerned. She pushed down the barriers. She pushed back when people said no. And she did it on behalf of the audience. And for Biddy, that is one child watching on their own in a flat or in a basement, replicated millions of times. And she was the one who taught me, certainly, when you're looking at that camera lens, she said, it's not like when you're on stage and you're talking to a whole audience full of people, a whole theatre. You are talking to one person. And just have that person in your mind. And I teach that now. And it really, really has, it's so true. And it is the key to presenting, I think. But also is to connect with that audience. And for her, there is no more important audience than that child of any age.
Sorry. Why did TV Centre pose the perfect setting for the execution of Blue Peter?
Well, I believe that it was perfect because it had a wonderful, first of all, location. And however much the BBC hates the whole London-centric view, it was very, very handy to get top guests before anyone else, before any of the programs that were on later in the evening, before, I mean, Biddy's thing was the scoop. She came from journalism and you always want the scoop. She'd want that person first. So back 100 years ago, Torvald Lindén won gold medals at the Olympics in Sarajevo. And everybody wanted to interview them. It was the first time we'd seen them dance bolero. And it was magical. Biddy was determined that we would be the first to get them to do the interview. And so to make sure, she organised a very fancy car I would go in that fancy car to Heathrow Airport. She knew people who knew people. She practically got me onto the tarmac in that car so that as they came down the steps of the airplane, they got straight into the car where we had cameras waiting inside. Now, that's the importance of being close to Heathrow Airport and grabbing a hold of people first. Oh, incidentally, I gave them their gold badges in the car at the same time. So we got the exclusive on that. And I think that Television Centre itself was, and I hate talking about it in the past tense, but it isn't now what it was, obviously. It's a beautiful, hugely expensive place to live. And there are now, there are two or three studios there, I think. You probably know better than me, but it's mostly ITV daytime studios there. When I first went to Television Centre, it was in the process of expanding. They kept adding bits on. So you've got this extraordinary circle in the middle. And then you've got a bit that sort of goes off at one side. So from the air, it looks like a question mark, which I love. I love the idea that it's all about asking questions. That circle that the offices all look into the middle, it feels quite protective. It feels protected almost from the outside world. But on the other hand, you've got the big statue of Ariel in the middle, which, of course, is all about looking out, getting those airwaves coming in, you know. And so there was a chaos about it. It was quite a chaotic building. And you really had to sort of learn your way around. But I think that a measure of chaos is necessary to be creative. I think it makes people feel comfortable to be creative. If there's a bit of, not mess, but just a little bit of craziness going around the place. And that if you worked on a program, say, going live, where you've got 3.25 hours live on a Saturday morning, there are lots of other people doing things in that building at the time. All sorts of different people. Might have been, back in the day, French and Saunders, upstairs trying to write the next series, going mad, but looking at going live on the TV in their office, and decide to pop down and just join in, which happened. You might have Elton John rehearsing for an evening show next door in the same building, who thinks, oh, I'll just pop in and say hello to Wham, who are on, George Michael or whatever. And so you've got this tremendous opportunity in the chaos of it all, in the relaxed nature of it all, to again, go through doors marked no entry. And the other thing about the whole thing of working at Television Centre as it was, is that you knew where, in amongst the chaos, you knew where to find people who could help you with ideas and could actually make decisions. So in those days, I would know where the head of whatever department was, because he or she would have an office. That isn't the same anymore. It's all hot desking and people are moving around and it's much more fluid and people change jobs much more quickly. So you haven't got that thing where you can say, knock, go and if the door's not open, knock on the door, then walk in and say, I've got an idea. And they might say, we don't like that idea. We hate it. Go away. But they might just say yes. And so it was a very enabling building.
And the executives were only ever just above you?
Yes. Yes, they were. They were, you mean physically above me in the building, or do you mean in terms of their power? Because in terms of their power, they were way above me. But in terms of the geography, they were right there on the, let me get this right. They were on the sixth floor, normally, I think, the execs. I mean, the more managerial people, you know, the chairman of the BBC and, he, and it has always been a he, was at Broadcasting House in the middle of London, which is now the place where the news comes from.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I think, Josh, that talking about Television Centre, it is fascinating to me, because that whole thing about the shape of the building and the question mark, you know, there's another building now at the end of Wood Lane, at the White City, where that was sort of the next place they built. And that was in a whole different era, when they had started farming things out to independent companies a lot more. And this was all to save money. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But the shape of that building, when you look at it, you look at a cross section, you look at the shape, it looks like a spreadsheet. It doesn't look like the chaotic, creative place that Television Centre was. And if you go into, I don't know how you've probably been into Broadcasting House in the middle of London, haven't you? Now,
I went to a new Broadcasting House about 5 years ago.
Yes, yeah, I got that, and I don't know what you thought of it, but it, you know, when you stand, you know, you go in the lift and you can see all the layers of it. It's like it's got all these tiers in it. And it looks like, this sounds dreadful, but it sort of looks like one of those insect nests where you've got people working away like ants or like on all these different layers. And right down at the very bottom is actually the television studio. Right down at the very bottom. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I know when I'm watching Hugh or Fiona or whoever presenting the news, I'll be worried that the whole weight of that building is going to come down on top of them. Because it's sort of all, I don't know, these people all, and again, there's nowhere to go and know that someone's going to be there. You've got all these zones, haven't you? You've got these pods where you're meant to go and think, you know, the thinking pod or a writing pod or a, and it's very prescribed. It's you're sort of told what you're meant to do. It doesn't feel like as creative a place. But when I'm talking like this, I realise I'm probably sounding like a real old git, you know, thinking, oh, it was so much better then than it is now. And that's not the case. There were some dreadful things about Television Centre that made it impossible sometimes. But I'm sure that there is a massive amount of creativity going on now within that building. But I suspect within Broadcasting House, but I suspect that most of the creativity happens outside and gets brought in. There you are. I've said it.
You thought most of the pictures on the walls were actually from TV Centre?
Yeah. Which pictures on the walls? At Broadcasting House, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that actually sort of, that doesn't surprise me, Josh, and that sort of corroborates what I was saying in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In 1983, following Rose McGill's creation of Swap Shop, you joined the presenting lineup for what was the latest incarnation of the Saturday morning children's offering, Saturday Superstore. In what ways did this show benefit from the spatial landscape which TV Centre could offer? And how did the ability to go between studios and show the inner workings of television enhance the quality of the show?
Oh my God, that's like a university thesis, that is. I might have asked you to repeat the question. No, it is. I mean, I could fill out books with that. Okay, what was the last bit of the question?
How did the ability to go between studios showing the inner workings of television, how did that enhance the quality of the show?
Oh, okay, right. Yes, so I went from Blue Peter almost seamlessly. That was in 1983, actually. I left Blue Peter and went to work on Superstore, which had already been up and running for a year, I believe. And they decided they needed a bit of female input because it was all boys presenting it. So I joined Superstore and it felt like I'd been set free in a way because, on Blue Peter, it was quite scripted. Because it was a shorter show and it had to be absolutely on time because we were right ahead of the news. You couldn't overrun. On Superstore, you'd got, instead of, you know, the half hour show of Blue Peter or 24 minutes, whatever it was, you'd got 3 1/4 hours. So there was much more flexibility within that. You still had to hit the points during the morning, but there was flexibility and we wrote our own scripts. Well, they weren't really scripts. It was a running order with, and we knew what was in each item in the running order. We discussed that on Friday morning, meeting on Monday, the previous Monday, to talk about the people who were going to come in and what ideas we had. And then on Friday, we'd go through the whole running order and put timings on everything. Go home on Friday night, I would flesh out interviews, do research, that kind of thing. Come in on Saturday morning, no rehearsal, and do it. And it was like, oh, this is such fun. Because what you started doing was working with the building, i.e. having ideas of, well, if we could get the crew, if I could take, and you see, technologically, things were changing so fast, where suddenly you've got wireless cameras, you've got, you know, and that developed a lot over the next 10 years, because I did Saturday morning. I did 4 years on Superstore, 6 years on Going Live. So the technology changed dramatically in that time. And that suited the building. That meant we could dive all over the place within the course of a 3.25 hour. You know, if there was a setup to, that you had to get something ready outside the building, for example, say you've got race cars coming into the horseshoe at the front, you'd be able to do that during the course of the cartoon, Thundercats or Ninja Turtles or whatever was on that morning. We could go out and get it set up during that time. And so it absolutely, I think the cross between the building itself and so much fun stuff being around that building, and able to happen that we could orchestrate around that building, coupled with the advances in technology, which undoubtedly happened because of the building, because people were working on that stuff right down in the basement, in the video department and everything. It absolutely influenced, if not directed, the whole feel of that show.
Of course, in 1987, Saturday Superstore morphed into Going Live, which put you alongside Philip Schofield. As a presenter, how easy is it to dual present alongside a fellow broadcaster? And what was the process you both took in order to achieve the perfect on-screen chemistry?
Oh, well, that's very nice, because I'm assuming what you're saying there, we had good chemistry. Do you know, if I knew the answer to that, I could bottle it and sell it. And it is something that, again, is just so lucky when that happens. And I really enjoyed working on Superstore. And I love working as part of a team. And working with Phil was the first time I'd worked really with one other person in such, I mean, I know the team was a lot bigger than one other person, because you'd got Trevor and Simon, who was so much an integral part, became so much an integral part of that team. And the crew, you know, the crew on the floor, we got to know them so well. And I do believe that the people who worked on the on sound and cameras and every other aspect, they loved working on that show, because everybody was a part of it. Everybody featured in it. And again, this is what made the feel of the show happen as well. The only bits that were ever rehearsed for Saturday mornings were the music guests' sequences, because they had to get all the timing right with the music and everything. So there'd be camera rehearsals without the actual artist there, obviously. That would be rehearsed on a Friday afternoon. And Trevor and Simon's sketches, they rehearsed them as well. And I would sometimes go and watch the camera rehearsal for the music guests and have ideas for, you know, what I do for an interview or little ideas. And very often the crew would feature in that too, especially if they were fans of that particular musician. I'd get them involved with it. And I think that helped the whole party feel of the show. But with Phil, I honestly, it's very hard to sum that up, really. I mean, we were both very young, and he is a couple of years, a couple of years younger than me. And this was everything he'd ever wanted to do, was work on Saturday mornings. Mm. And it was so lovely to work alongside someone who absolutely appreciated what a fabulous job this was. It was, I think Keith had that too. Keith Chegwin certainly had that. Bless him. But to work side by side like that with, and we got each other. We just got each other's sense of humor. And I would far rather work in a partnership than on my own. Far rather. I think you bounce off each other and ideas build, and I find it easier to be creative. I mean, it's never easy being creative, and it happens almost without you realizing it when it happens at its best. And I found that working with Phil, that happened for both of us. And we really, really enjoyed and enjoy each other's company. And I think that helps. Yeah. I've been very lucky with that because I had the same thing with Simon and Peter.
Your answer kind of leads into the next question, which was, how do you think your mutual passion for television helped your on-screen chemistry with Philip?
Completely. Completely. It really did. The passion for television helped the chemistry, but the chemistry helped the presenting. And I think helps any show if you have got that, if there is a willingness there. And I say willingness, but that didn't even enter into the picture because we were both so keen to get this show right and just enjoyed the whole process of it. But, you know, I've worked on hundreds of television programs, and that's not me boasting. It's just because I'm old and it's a fact. You're meant to say you're not old, Sarah. You're not. Thank you. But I have worked with people who are not of that ilk. You know, they have certain feelings about how important they are, and we're not so willing to share and create, co-create. And it's always a huge shock, because I suppose I've been very spoilt by my co-hosts in the past, you know?
They say don't work with animals or children, but Going Live spawned its own childhood hero. Why do you think Gordon the Gopher struck a chord with the television audience? And how difficult is it to present live TV with a squeaky puppet?
I don't know what you're talking about, squeaky puppet. No, I'm sorry. Gordon the Gopher is a gopher. He was a gopher. And to me, I suppose that's where the acting comes in. I absolutely could suspend my disbelief. And even though I could see Paul Smith's hand operating a fairy sock, to me, he has a personality not dissimilar to Paul's. And I don't know how much it helped knowing Paul. And if I tell you that now Paul has a very lofty position at the BBC in management, Gordon has risen to those dizzy heights I was talking about, way up there at the top of the broadcasting house. I don't know if Paul is still doing that, but a couple of years ago, we were interviewed together, and he was then head of compliance or something, which is very, very important and very high up. So he's probably even higher up now. But you see, that's where Gordon got to. It was actually very funny because, so Paul is there behind the desk. I mean, fortunately, he was very slim because he had to kind of crouch in that kind of bit between Phil and I on that desk. And he was crouched in there like this, and he's got a monitor. He's got a little tiny TV monitor in there so he can see our reactions to things. So it's not just dependent upon what we're saying to him. In fact, that's actually not that important. It's more the look or the gesture. And, you know, that's that at that stage, that was quite unusual with a creature to be able to do that, so that you've got that timing. And what Paul was brilliant at with his puppetry, with his gopher, was the timing of a look. And how he manipulated it, and honestly, I think, again, very easy to take that skill for granted. And as far as I know, he was certainly not trained as a puppeteer, but he just got it. And so for me, it was totally believable working with Gordon the Gopher. He was another member of the team that I should have mentioned earlier.
But it must have been strange to know how he reacted.
Yeah. How Gordon reacted?
Yeah.
Strange. Well, it was, actually. I mean, it took some getting used to, in that it was quite sophisticated in a funny way. I mean, yes, you call him a puppet, a toy, whatever, a furry sock, or Gordon the Gopher. There was a sort of adult approach in there. And I think that it's interesting you mention that, because I think going live, the criticism it always used to get from the powers that be within the upper echelons of children's television. By that stage, Edward Barnes had moved on to other things. And the then head of children's programs, Anna Hume, made the quite justifiable criticism that, is this really a children's program or is it for adults? And we'd never put an age on it, really, because we knew the age of the people writing to us and ringing in and doing all that stuff that we used to do on a Saturday morning, and they were all absolutely the target age group. Occasionally, you'd get a rogue one that got through. But you know what I'm talking about. But apparently, the biggest demographic when they did all the analysis on it was that our main, that was between the age of 16 and 35, which, all right, was a bit above where we possibly should have been. But I think that the younger audience, they got it. They absolutely got it. And it just meant that it was a true family show, where there was something in it for everybody. And if some of the gags were a little bit adult, that didn't affect the children at all, because they just, you know, either wouldn't see it, wouldn't understand it or whatever. Adults would. It's a bit like when you go to a pantomime. When you go to see a pantomime, there are jokes of all levels there. There's a lot of innuendo. We didn't do a lot of innuendo, but there were things that would certainly appeal to an older audience and a younger audience. I think that was not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. And Gordon kind of sums that up, going right back. Sorry, I'm very long-winded today. But it's that Gordon had that, with a look, with a gesture, there was a sophistication there, I think.
W12-7RJ, Wood Lane, Shepherd's Bush, became a recognisable address for children growing up in the 80s. How do you think this interactivity created a sentimental and enduring rapport between children of the 80s and TV Centre as a whole?
Well, you'll have to ask them, actually. I get the feeling from the way in which it's written about and talked about. And I'm not a Facebook person, but I am on Twitter, as you know, Josh. That's how we come to be talking to each other. And it's fascinating how many people get that nostalgic resonance with the address and with the phone number 081-811-8181. I mean, you know, it's extraordinary how many people there. And then there are arguments about when it changed, on what date it changed. And people, you know, it means a lot to people because it was theirs. They owned it. They felt it was theirs. It belonged to them. And we've all had things in growing up watching television or listening to the radio, in my case, quite a lot, where I feel that I'm invested in that. Part of that belongs to me. And I think that is a terrific thing about the BBC, that it has engendered that feeling with people.
Every generation is like a little elite group.
Every generation is like a little elite group.
Yes, that is true. And do you know what? I don't know. Again, it's one that you can. I don't know whether you'd agree with me. That if we're lucky, we each feel we belong to the best elite group, or, you know, that we the golden age was when we were going through that bit. I did a documentary. I was asked to be in a documentary quite a few years ago now called The Golden Age of Children's Television. And I think it came to me during that documentary when I was being interviewed, because it was the title of the show, The Golden Age. And I said, well, you know, I think the fantastic thing is that we all on our side of it, who were the protagonists, if you like, that we all feel that our age was the golden age. And isn't that terrific, actually? Isn't that great that we feel that? Because hopefully we were sort of doing the right thing. I'm certainly appreciated doing that work.
Like most British landmarks, TV Centre had bespoke features which were easily recognisable to almost any television fan. The donut, the BBC sign outside with the white egg cups, and the sculpture of Helios each contributed to its uniqueness and beauty. When entering TV Centre for the first time, how aware were you of what the building meant to British television?
Well, again, I take you right back to your first question. Because I toddled in there as a little un all those years ago, probably I only realised many, many, many years later quite how beautiful that building was, is. They always say you only miss it when it's gone. Well, I missed it before that. I missed it a long time before that. And if you're of my age group and you grew up with that very 1960s architecture, which could be quite brutal, and Television Centre isn't brutal by any stretch, partly because of the features that you mentioned in the question there. But the way it was built inside, you know, there's a staircase in there, and I don't know if you have you been to Television Centre, Josh? You have. Well, do you know when you go up towards main reception, you've got those big pillars outside, haven't you, that you go through, and they're all covered in mosaics, the pillars, and you turn right to go into main reception. If you look directly opposite the other side of the circle, so if where you go in is on the clock is 6, if you look up to 12, there's a staircase that goes all the way up the building. And that staircase was actually built, don't ask me, because I'm not an architect, what this actually means, but it floats. There is no apparent support for the staircase. So architecturally, there are some extraordinary features about it. But I remember driving up to, because it was like home to me, you know, I sort of did my television growing up there. And just a few years ago, when they were midway through all the reworking of it, I drove up Wood Lane. I was driving up from Shepherd's Bush north towards where the A40 goes east to west, west to east. And I drove up and I did a double take, and I could see straight through that the big chunk had been knocked down. And I actually burst into tears. it was such a shock.
Yeah.
And it represented the end of that particular era. And I thought it was very sad. And I mean, I know they're still using it for television now. And weirdly, of course, you know, it's mainly ITV because life has changed, as it should, as it has to. It evolves. And it's now not BBC Television Centre, it's Television Centre. But it's still Television Centre. And if you go across the road to Westfield, the great big shopping centre, and you go up to the top floor of John Lewis, where they've got their cafe, and you go out on the balcony, you can look right across and see and get a fantastic view of what it looks like now. But what is strange is there's a very fancy schmancy club at the side of it, built up one side of it, which is Soho House, which is a members club. And on the top floor of that is a swimming pool. And the thought that where the old BBC club was, where all the pigeons used to go and poop outside on the balcony, there's now a swimming pool, which it costs you an absolute fortune to belong to this club and go and swim. And the great view from the swimming pool is right across to Wormwood Scrubs Prison. Yes! It's a very different world now. It's very different. And I'm not meaning to sound depressing and saying it's worse. I mean, as I say, in many ways, it's a much more glamorous place than ever it was. But I'm not sure how chaotic and creative it still is.
How did the consumerism attitude of the 1980s serve the BBC's desire to use TV Centre to its full potential?
I'm not sure is the short answer to that. I'm not sure how much consumerism affected the BBC in the 1980s. Going ahead to the 1990s, there was a completely different overview of how the BBC should proceed. But, you know, when you've got an organisation, institution, which was and is hanging on by its fingernails to a license fee payer's funding, you have a responsibility there to the license fee payer, to the audience. So I'm not sure how is that what you meant about the consumerism of the 80s affecting.
So Josh is saying that Margaret Thatcher told people to go out and make money and people were making a lot of money, but how did the BBC as a non-profit organisation compete with that?
I don't know that it felt any pressure to compete with that. I really don't. And where I was, obviously at that stage, still very firmly entrenched within the children's area of television, I think certainly on Blue Peter, the underlying feeling of all that it was the antithesis of perhaps the I mean, you know, Margaret Thatcher is a tricky one in this conversation, because of course there was all part of it that went round with a shopping bag and the other. And I interviewed Margaret Thatcher twice, actually. Once on, well, I chatted to her on Superstore, off camera, I hasten to add, because I think it was John Craven who talked to her on did the actual interview. But I did interview her during the 90s, on another live program that I worked on for quite a while on Pebble Mill and on the on Good Morning. It was like it was called Good Morning Britain, but it was BBC then. And that was very interesting because, you know, part of her was all about, oh, being the grocer's daughter from Grantham and make do and mend and save money where you can and work hard. And it wasn't what she gave up wasn't blatant consumerism. But of course, what she and her chancellors set in motion was the opportunity for that and perhaps a more consumerist direction for people to take, and the policies enabled that consumerism to happen. So within television, it probably had more of an effect on commercial television than on than on public service broadcasting, I think. And there was probably, I think the BBC's job was always to question whoever was in power at the time. And BBC has traditionally been accused of being left-leaning. Now, I don't necessarily think it is. I think it treads a very careful balance, treads very carefully. There have been some notable exceptions to this, I know, but I think was it Kate Adie who summed it up really well. It might have been another. I think it was Kate Adie who said that over the years in radio and television, you know you've done it right on a political program when you get the same number of complaints accusing you of being left leaning as accusing you of being right leaning when people have listened to the same or watched the same interview, and then you know you've got it somewhere right. But in terms of how that consumerism affected television and affected the BBC, I think if consumerism seeps through and affects everything about a society, about its fashion, about its style, then I suppose we are all affected, even to having great big shoulder pads in jackets, if you think about it. You know, all suddenly looking like, you know, we've all got these great big sofas on our shoulders. Is that because everybody felt they had to look like Gordon Gekko because they were all out there making money? I don't know. I'm trying very hard to find a link for you there. But I didn't feel it, but then I was living in it. So I don't know. It might be one of those that you see much more clearly than I can, because you are looking at it with a better perspective, perhaps. I don't know.
In 1992, you became part of British television folklore when you starred alongside the legendary Michael Parkinson and your late husband, the much-missed Mike Smith, for the cult spoof Ghost Watch. How did it feel to be doing something so edgy and groundbreaking for the first time? What was the strangest reaction which you encountered to the show?
Oh, my goodness. Another huge, huge question. So at the time, this idea had been mentioned to Mike, first of all, actually. They said that they'd like him to be in this really weird idea for a play, a television play, a drama. That had been written by Stephen Volk, and they'd got an amazing director who really her main thing is films, and they want it to look like a live broadcast, and so they had Michael Parkinson in place, and they wanted Mike to be in the studio with him. They hadn't cast the female presenter yet, and I can't remember that it was Mike or me. Or Leslie Manning, the director, who said, well, it's obvious, have Sarah. I mean, that would work. That would give a whole other edge to it. And Stephen, the writer, loved that idea because it gave him a little bit more. He could then flesh that out and there'd be another relationship there. So reading the script, again, it was a bit like a going live script. The actors who were in it, they had definite scripts, you know, lines to learn. So people like Gilly Bevan, who was in the studio with Mike Parkinson, being the expert in the studio, she had proper lines to learn. But as far as my interaction with the family, with Michelle and Sid, that their real names, and with Breege, who played their mum, there wasn't really any script. We were just told, we were given bullet points of what the storyline was, and we could improvise within that. Now, I had my whole training, my background as an actress, was really, as well as learning reams of lines from everything from Shakespeare to very modern plays, but there was a lot of improvisation. So this, coupled with all my experience as a presenter, meant that it felt very natural. So we were combining acting a story and presenting live. And also Mike Smith, as opposed to Michael Parkinson, and I had been involved with lots of programs with the word watch on the end of them at that stage. It was a great big fashion for it. There was hospital watch, airport watch, rail watch. So Ghost Watch just seemed like it was part of the same series, if you like. Mm-hmm. And so there was something very natural about it, except that it was about something that could be seen as real. And Mike and I probably were, I think Michael Parkinson, he believed that people would absolutely realize it was a play. Absolutely, because there was a Radio Times front cover, there were all the credits there. It had that feel of being a play. And at the beginning it said Ghost Watch, written by Stephen Volk, directed by Leslie Manning. You know, how much more clear could you be? But of course, possibly Mike and I being involved with a lot more live television of a sort of news type nature, if you like, actuality, you realize that people don't pay much attention actually to the television. It's on in the corner. It's a bit of moving wallpaper. They certainly don't take in the fact that there's opening credits or end credits. You know, why should they? They've got much better things to do with their lives. They only notice when something extraordinary happens most of the time, or, you know, they're fans of the program already. But as we know, a lot of people thought that it was real. But leading up to it, it was very much recorded. It was recorded over 2 months it took to make that program. And the first month was all in the house. And the second month was at Elstree Studios. So all that interaction that you see between the house and the studio were actually recorded a month apart from each other. And so again, people, I think, slightly forgot the impact that it might have once it was edited together. And I remember that when Mike had finished doing all the stuff at Elstree with Michael Parkinson, and we asked to go and see Ruth Baumgarten, who was the exec producer on it at Television Centre. So we made an appointment to go and see her and said, look, Ruth, you probably think we are worrying unnecessarily, but we both feel that this will have a really extraordinary impact on people and that there needs to be something else happen. I don't mean a spoiler. We don't mean that. But, you know, you've been giving out the phone number in the script, the going live phone number, as it was at that time. And why not have a program on the end of it? Because the last thing people see is me disappearing into under the stairs, apparently going to be mauled to death by cats or whatever. I know it's after the watershed, but we all know nobody takes any notice of that anyway. So how would it be if we had a live, actual, real, live in, phone in, after that, talking about people's reactions to the show and getting people's reactions and having something happening either in a studio or just something. If you want, you know, that there would be an announcement at the end of the show. If you want to talk about Ghostwatch and what you thought of it, tell us, give us a call. You might have real ghost stories to tell. It wouldn't have spoiled the show, but I think it would have saved a bit of flack afterwards. And it would have been quite fun, actually. I thought it would be quite fun. Anyway, they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to do that. And of course, you know, it went out and it had a huge audience and it had an amazing reaction. And the weird thing is, I think more people, well, millions more people, I mean, it got a massive audience on the night, but it sort of gets more popular every year. It gains a new audience. And even though it now looks quite old-fashioned, you know, it does look old-fashioned, I think there's something about the story and something about the energy of it, which still holds up for people watching it for the first time. And I think that's down to the writing of it and certainly down to Leslie's direction. I do. And I don't think that we realized it was going to be groundbreaking. I think Mike and I realized there might be a lot of it hitting the fan straight after, but we didn't think of it as groundbreaking. I don't know that you ever do when you're at the time when you're doing something. You don't sort of realize. And it's only with hindsight that you see that it really did. It did break ground and it laid the foundations for things like the Blair Witch Project, Most Haunted, all those sorts of programs, you know?
Why do you have one like that?
Why do you think there hasn't been another one like that?
I think the BBC would be very nervous of it. I mean, they won't even repeat it. It's been asked, you know, people have repeatedly asked the BBC to repeat it and they won't repeat it, which sort of makes me giggle because, I think it would be fun, but part of me thinks actually maybe it's best they don't because then it stays in that kind of slightly cult niche area. I don't know that you could, but to go back to your question, Josh, I don't think you could do another one because it's been done and that people would spot it a mile off. You know, they'd say, well, yeah, this is a drama. And actually, did you see, oh gosh, I can't remember the title now, but, what was the series that the guys who did League of Gentlemen, Mark Gatiss and Reese, yes, they did a sort of homage, didn't they? They did a homage, a tribute to Ghostwatch on one, and I think that was, and I watched that, I thought it was very good, but they weren't trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes with it, and so I don't know that you could do that again, really.
Throughout the 80s and 90s, you were among an elite group who were the BBC's leading TV presenters. What's it like coping with the responsibility of being the BBC's go-to girl?
Well, I was. I don't think I am anymore. I think, yes, it is. It was a responsibility, Josh. You're right. And it was one that I, especially when you're working in the children's department, and I suppose it kind of suited me, really. I was never head girl at school or anything like that, you know. I really wasn't, and I wouldn't say that I was ever a goody two shoes. And I suppose also I was quite lucky in that it was very much in the days before mobile phones with cameras and social media. I think it's harder now. And it's not that I was out there, you know, burning the candle at both ends all the time, but I was allowed to have a private life to an extent. Weird thing has happened. I think the press behave now slightly better than they used to. This is pre, now post Leveson. There are more, they have to behave better. Pre Leveson, it was a free for all, and the press would do whatever they could to find a story, invent a story, get in on something that was happening. I mean, the worst thing that ever happened to me was, well, it didn't even happen to me. I was actually unconscious at the time, but journalists dressing, I kid you not, dressing up as doctors and nurses to get into the hospital where I was after we had our helicopter crash. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I mean, the iniquity of that, of getting in the way of professional medics trying to do their job and someone grabbing hold of someone wearing a white coat, which they did in those days, because someone down the corridor has maybe had some terrible disaster, a cardiac arrest, and they grab hold of someone. It turns out he's a sleazy journalist, you know. I mean, and that happened. That happened. Nowadays, things are, they behave a lot better. However, what you have now is, you know, being policed by the public, if you like, and pictures and, you know, phones shoved in people's faces and all the rest of it while they're trying to have a bit of time, maybe just with their families or whatever. But it did mean that I did take that responsibility seriously. And I think part of the thing that was lucky for me is that I am an older sister. I'm a big sister. I have a younger brother and a younger sister, and my sister was a lot younger than me. She is a lot younger than me, I must say, in case she's watching. she's a whole lot. But I felt, I mean, my sister was very much of the absolute target age group of the Blue Peter audience when I was on it. She was often a guest on it because Biddy thought it was just too good to be true, having a presenter with a little sister who had already won a Blue Peter. She'd already got a Blue Peter badge before I was ever on the show. She'd done a drawing and sent it in and got a badge. So, you know, it was, I perhaps had an inbuilt sense of the way in which a child sees the world and what my, not boundaries, because it didn't feel like boundaries, but, you know, if you've been lucky enough to get this job, you have a responsibility to the job and to yourself, but mostly to your audience. Mm-hmm. Because if it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be there, you know? I was proud of being on Blue Peter and proud of that show. I'm proud of the Saturday morning programs as well. And, you know, you don't want to let them down. So, yeah, I did and I do take that responsibility seriously, very seriously.
Throughout the 90s into the next millennium, TV Centre was still the home of the corporation's entertainment output, creating new vehicles, new platforms and, more importantly, new stars. As someone who defined the cutting edge of live TV during the 80s, how did it feel to return to the place that held such significance within your career?
When I returned to it, did you say? At what stage do you mean returning?
Yeah.
Later on in your career.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you the time when it was just came home to me so much about missing something when it's not there anymore, was when I went back to present a documentary, Tales of Television Centre. And we shot that obviously all around different locations within the building. And it was empty, and it was, oh dear, it was very sad. It was very sad. Mm-hmm. It was fun to recount some of the things that happened in the places that I went and did the pieces to camera from and walked through. But it was a tremendous sense of melancholy, really. I'm sorry to be so negative about it, but it wasn't. I was very honoured to make that program. It was written and produced by a lovely chap who you might have talked to. I don't know, and if you haven't, can I recommend that you do? Richard Marson. He was editor of Blue Peter at some stage. Have you met Richard?
Yeah.
Well, I will absolutely recommend, because not only is he the most fabulous teller of stories, and he will make you absolutely weep with laughter, but he cares so much about this. He really cares. And he's got an incredible memory, an incredible brain, and he is so witty. But he made that program, and we were both, I mean, sort of so sad the day that we finished recording it there, because it was this sort of sense of the end of something, you know, the end of that era.
I think you've kind of answered this one, what you've just told us. But on, Josh has said, on Friday the 22nd of March 2013, BBC TV Centre closed its doors for the final time. What was your reaction to this?
Sadness. Just real sadness. And it's that's all I can say, really, because on a personal level, I had been there, as you now know, as a little girl, watching people at work, and it's a very serious place of work, but it was also a fun factory. Mm-hmm. Things could happen. It's a very exciting place, set within this building, which in the late '50s, in the early '60s, it must have seemed so cutting edge in its design, and then got all kind of jumbly as things got added onto it and got more adventurous, perhaps because of that feeling less of a corporation, more of a creative enterprise, I think. And then, when it wasn't going to be functioning on that level anymore and all got a bit smartened up, and it's terribly smart now, it doesn't have quite that that family sense, that it's all a bit transient now. And again, that possibly it's the transience of not having your own desk, not having your own office anymore. You have to share it with everybody else, which is fair enough, but it's a different feel. It's a different feel. And I have to temper all that by saying, yeah, but what's that got to do with anybody else? What's that got to do with the audience? That's not going to affect them. And I hope that it doesn't. I hope that it doesn't. These are just my personal, very selfish views, you know.
Looking at broadcasting as a whole, how significant is TV Centre in the story of British popular culture?
Hugely important, because of all the things that we've talked about, and the fact that under one roof you had every department there. Things weren't scattered about all over the country, all over the city. I mean, they were a bit scattered out all over Shepherd's Bush. In that, you know, you'd got all the wardrobe department was across the road where Westfield is now, and you'd have to toddle across there. And if you were when I was acting, you know, you'd toddle across to do an audition across the road or down to Shepherd's Bush Green. There were offices there that you had to go to every now and again, but it was all. It was all under one roof, really and truly, which meant that things could happen quickly. And when good ideas happen, they tend to happen quickly, good ideas. If you don't execute them within a certain amount of time, they can go off the boil. And because everything was close in proximity, you could make these things happen quickly. And I think that has, in the long term, an enormous effect on what get seen on screen, and then in the popular consciousness of as you say, of viewers.
What's the legacy of TV Centre?
I think some tremendous television programmes. Really, that's it, in a nutshell. Some tremendous programming.
And then looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Oh, I don't know. I've got one, really. I don't know about achievements. It's very hard to talk about one's own sort of career in terms of achievements. I mean, if I was going to achieve something, I'd like to think I haven't done it yet, but it's still to come, you know? But I remember my sister saying to me once, I entered a competition, a produce show, at Kew and at Kew Gardens in London, and I made some jam out of the figs that came from a tree which I had planted. And it was done very seriously, the way I made my jam, but also the whole judging thing. I had to take it to a special tent and leave it there and go away. And they had proper judges come in to judge, you know, the biggest carrot or the smallest, you know, cherry tomato, and the cooking as well, the cakes and the jam. And I went back, and my sister was with me, and I got first prize. I got an RHS, a Royal Horticultural Society rosette, first prize. I was so proud and thrilled. And my sister said, she said, you know, the most extraordinary thing is, she said, I've seen you win countless awards for television. You know, you've won best woman on TV however many times or whatever. I have never seen you look so thrilled as when you got first prize for your pot of jam. I know that my fig jam wasn't on TV, but that's one of my proudest achievements in my life. no, listen, you know what they say, if you love your work, it's not work. And I really do love my work. So it's not really been like work very often. And so it's very hard for me to see it in terms of sort of achievements and things, really, because I love it so much. I think let's say my fig jam, which is yet to be seen on TV. You've got an exclusive there. It's the first time I've ever mentioned it in a broadcast.
and then finally, what's next for Sarah Green?
Okay. Well, what's next for Sarah Green is, now, how soon will this be, people will be able to...
probably around mid-March.
Okay. So by that stage, I don't know whether the current series of Would I Lie to You, I'll be on that. I'm going to be on Meet the Richardsons on Channel 5. And there is a series coming up, which I'm not allowed to talk about yet, but it's a series, and it's BBC One. There you go. And again, you've got the exclusive on that.